Welcome back. It's a Thursday, the 16th day of June, 2022. I'm your host, Mark Call, and it is the day after the Fed meeting where the Fed revealed, well, take your pick, one of two things. Either they finally realize that they are way, way behind the curve and inflation is completely out of control, and oh, even though it's too late, we better try to do something about it and at least look like we know what's going on. Or, and I tend to lean this way, folks, they realized, who are we kidding? There's no hiding the fact anymore that the Great Reset is what we've been working up to all along, and we might as well just pull out the stops and stick a fork in it. The U.S. economy is done.
Let's go, Brandon. I agree.
Yes, that's kind of, sort of, but late to the party. Expected. The Fed did hike interest rates on Wednesday by a stunning, but at least lately not unexpected, full 75 basis points, 0.75%, the biggest hike since 1994. Because, I hope you're sitting down, they are strongly committed to fighting inflation, now that they've succeeded in making sure it's completely beyond their control. They also sharply lowered their growth and employment outlooks, now that's not a surprise, and warned that, well, the pain is just beginning, but we already knew that. And it also looks like the global coordinated stagflation, in the name of the Great Reset, is not limited to the formerly free United States. But the death of a fully fiat global reserve currency does tend to have that effect. It is still, though, tough to ignore the WTF, or is it World Economic Forum, involvement in all of this. And to make that point, we'll do a quick headline review. Here's some of Zero Hedge's opening lineup this morning. In a shock decision, they say, oh, how many of those are we going to see of late? The Swiss National Bank has hiked rates for their first time in 15 years and warned they may also, joining the global parade, sell billions in stocks. They've made a, quote, complete U-turn in their currency management policy. In no longer Great Britain, the pound tumbled after the Bank of England hiked rates 25 basis points, 0.25%, in a split decision. And that, says coverage, is a smaller move than what most global banksters are delivering up. But it does reaffirm worries about the potential for recession and sent the pound tumbling as much as 1% against the fiat dollar. And the BOE also dropped any guidance about future rate hikes. You'll just have to guess along with the rest of the world and see what it is that Klaus and company want. And it's gone, says another headline. World's billionaires see $1.4 trillion in fake fiat wealth evaporate amid market turmoil. Australia's national energy market has been suspended. They say it's impossible to continue operating, and a clear signal that the energy crisis, where, well, worldwide, but this time too in eastern Australia, is intensifying. And there's this follow-up, of course, to the FOMC. Futures crash, and the Dow's down, well, at this point, over 700 points, as the reality of the current recession sets in. In our preview, they say, of how to trade the Fed's 75 basis point rate hike, we said to at first expect a knee-jerk move higher, especially if we get an outsized hike, hinting that the Fed is hoping to catch up to the curve, then a gradual drift lower, which was echoed later by Goldman. Sure enough, in the aftermath of the FOMC's announcement Wednesday, we got that knee-jerk move higher, and then overnight, the drift lower has appeared right on schedule, with futures tumbling in the U.S., undoing the entire post-FOMC move higher, and dragging global stocks lower too, as traders come to grips with the realization that this full 0.75% bunch of rate hikes, far from being bullish, means that a recession is now, well, basically baked in the cake. And as I began the recording this morning, folks, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down over 700 points, with similar or worse losses across the board in indices like the S&P 500 and NASDAQ. They quote the chief market analyst at IG Group in London, Chris Beauchamp, who wrote, "It hasn't taken long for the post-Fed bounce in stocks to fade, and given the gloomier outlook for growth, that's hardly surprising. We're still living in the same world we were 24 hours ago, one where growth is slowing, earnings are still falling, and prices, here's a shocker, just keep on rising. This," he wrote, "is not a great environment for stocks." Finally, there's the real estate market meltdown, arguably just about on schedule. U.S. housing starts and permits collapse in May, says one more headline here from Zero Hedge. Amid surging layoffs in the real estate market, slumping home builder sentiment, soaring rates, and plunging mortgage applications, it's no surprise that analysts expected a drop in housing starts and permits in May. They were down 1.8% MOM and 2.5% month over month, respectively, while those numbers were destroyed themselves as housing starts crashed 14% month over month, while permits plunged 7%. And the drop was even more pronounced in housing starts for multifamily or rental units, which outright collapsed. All of this is the biggest drop in housing starts since the economy was shut down by Big Brother in April of 2020, courtesy, of course, of the COVID-1984 pandemic panic. From there, on we go to a bit of analysis, first courtesy of Ryan McMakin via the Mises Institute, who recaps the FOMC's announcement. They raised the federal funds rate 0.75% from 1% to 1.75%. The June meeting was the third this year at which the FOMC has raised rates. But coming into March this year, however, the FOMC hadn't bothered to raise the target rate since March of 2020, even though price inflation began to accelerate, some would even say move out of control. Your host was certainly one of those during the second half of 2021. And notably, this increase comes mere weeks after Fed Chairman Powell slapped down any idea of a 75 basis point increase in June. As reported by Reuters just a month ago, May 4th, Powell had insisted, quote, a 75 basis point increase is not something that the committee is actively considering, unquote. And yeah, that didn't last long. But the fact that the Fed was forced to hike the target rate, he says, by higher than they had claimed wasn't even going to be possible earlier in the year, is a reminder that the Fed and its so-called economists are simply in a reactionary mode when it comes to the U.S. economy's problem with mounting price inflation. And as even Powell admitted during the press conference, the Fed was surprised, shocked even, I tell you, by just how high price inflation has already grown. They then had to pivot in order to answer calls that the central bank do something, do anything about price inflation. But it's obvious, he continues, that when it comes to setting target rates, there is no model. The plan, to the extent that one even exists at all, is let's just see how bad inflation is, then we'll pick a target rate and hope maybe that solves the problem. Your host has suggested, of course, that the real way to phrase this is no, they just back up until they hear glass breaking. And then sometimes they panic and hit the gas. But, continues the author, while some so-called Fed watchers are now framing their policy as exceptionally hawkish, Powell himself stated that, in his opinion, quote, right now our policy rate is well below neutral, and that a target rate of 1.75% is only moderately restrictive. So, says McMakin, if a 40-year high in inflation calls for only moderately restrictive policy that still remains below neutral, it's difficult to imagine just how much inflation will be necessary before the Fed finally regards truly restrictive policy as the right medicine actually necessary. Ask about the so-called dot plot and the suggestion of some Fed members that the target rate may reach 3.8% next year, but will even that be enough to rein in price inflation? Powell responded to the question by saying, well, we'll know when we get there, unquote. So I'll have to say it again. Keep listening for that sound of breaking glass. Zero Hedge's own team, writing as Tyler Durden, says that what with recession now being guaranteed, a one-term White House has begun to panic. Okay, we should take that with a grain of salt. This was their plan all along, and your host thinks that's now pretty much obvious. For the reasons that I don't think it's elections anymore they're worried about, it's how to successfully rig them, and then, again, successfully get away with it. They quote a bunch of Powellisms, which suggests he maybe still believes that it's blue skies as far as anyone can see. Things like, there's no sign of a broader slowdown in the economy, and real GDP growth has picked up this quarter. And yeah, even, quote, it appears the U.S. economy is in a strong position, which obviously isn't exactly true. And they quote Gundlach asking CNBC, well, just where is this strong economy people talk about? Meanwhile, the latest survey of CEO confidence outright refuted any happy talk from the Biden puppet. The conference board measure slipped to 42 in the second quarter, the lowest level since the onset of the pandemic, and down from 57 in just the prior period. And historically, they note, a reading of that level has coincided with profit recessions or negative year-over-year changes in earnings. What's even more remarkable, they go on to say, is that the latest estimates from Bloomberg Economics, a leftist pro-Biden media outlet run by Democrat billionaire Michael Bloomberg, admits that a recession by the start of 2024, barely even on the radar of leftist economists just a few months ago, is now virtually assured at least a 3-in-4 probability. All of which means Biden is a one-termer. The mood, they write, has turned sour at an alarming pace, putting Biden at risk of joining an unenvied club. No, not just those that have gone senile in office, but from Jimmy Carter to George Herbert Walker Bush to Donald Trump, one-term U.S. presidents in the past half-century all had their election hopes fatally injured by the lingering effects of a recession. Well, some of them actually had their election hopes dashed by fraud, but that's another story, and you're not going to hear it from Bloomberg. This is cute, though. At least Biden's pollsters are starting to wonder how they're going to cover it up. Celinda Lake, one of Biden's top pollsters during the 2020 fake election, says her focus groups are awash with talk of the rising cost of things like gasoline and housing, and how wages aren't keeping up with it. We ask, if the economy were the weather, how would you describe it? And she says voters have been describing things like storms and thunderstorms. And even by Wednesday, says Zero Hedge, it's been a hell of a week already for Biden. Monday, there was a bear market. Tuesday, mass layoffs. And Wednesday, of course, the Fed 75 basis point hike going into a recession. And it's only midweek. Which leads us to the real warnings in this piece. The White House certainly won't go down swinging, they suggest. The administration's economists have been modeling extreme scenarios from a new booga 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 coronavirus or maybe booga booga pox variant to even a bigger spike in oil prices. That's no doubt in their plans, folks. So they've prepared to act fast in case of an emergency that they've planned coming to fruition. This, according to a senior White House official who admittedly didn't quite phrase it that way. But as Zero Hedge notes, in short, better get ready for another surprise, an emergency shock meant to distract from the shit show that is Biden's economy and Powell's galloping inflation and bear market. Only after the fiasco that was the monkeypox false start, it's difficult to visualize just what, short of another staged war, like this time, say, over Taiwan, the Biden propaganda machine will come up with, or folks that his puppet masters have probably already come up with and are prepping to unleash. One thing is certain, though, you know they'll try. And you better brace for a very hot summer full of Soros-funded protests in both 2023, if not this year, certainly 2024, as the far left and their socialist Democrats go all in to avoid another humiliating sweep in 2024, what with Trump, they say, lurking in the shadows. One of several stories I've seen lately comparing the, well, attack, war, which is called treason if you actually read the Constitution, against the American citizenry with what's being done to, say, foreign invaders, comes from Victor Davis Hanson. He called it the subordinate citizen and begins by noting he recently led a group of about 100 people on a tour of Israel for nearly 2 weeks, all of them U.S. citizens. But before returning to the United States, the participants had to indicate their booga booga vaccination status and take a COVID-1984, admittedly bogus though, PCR test in order to be allowed to re-enter their own country. Anxiety swept the group as the testers swabbed them, because anybody testing positive would have to delay his or her return, probably spend thousands of dollars finding scarce hotel accommodations, living expenses, and rebooking airline tickets, depending upon the length of their mandatory sequestration. So, he says, think about it. Contrast that with the tens of thousands, or arguably hundreds of thousands, of foreign nationals now mustering south of the border to cross illegally across the border of the once sovereign United States. And they follow on the heels of the already 2 million who've entered the country unlawfully since the puppet masters for the Biden Fuhrer rigged and stole the election. He asked it this way. Does any foreign national actually worry about being tested for COVID-19, or for that matter anything else, much less fear being turned away if he tests positive or lacks proof of vaccination? Of course not! So isn't it funny that we scrutinize far more carefully actual legal U.S. citizens re-entering what they thought was their own country legally than we do non-citizens invading our country unlawfully? And for that matter, let's consider the government is still determined to fire thousands of federal workers and, of course, U.S. military personnel who have refused to take the mandated poison poke, a.k.a. DNA mods known as mRNA not vaccinations. Most citizens who have declined to be vaccinated fear, rightfully, that the injections are dangerous, basically untested except on guinea pigs who are showing that they should never have been emergency use authorized to begin with. Certainly ineffective in preventing COVID-19 infections, and that they wouldn't necessarily, no, not ever, lead to herd immunity. So you gotta ask, are 2 million unvaccinated foreigners arriving unaudited from impoverished countries less of a threat somehow during the pandemic than fully audited American citizens employed by the federal government? Why would we fire unvaccinated Americans but welcome equally unvaccinated illegal invaders? Well, there is a reason, folks. We've talked about it here for a long time, but he's working up to it, and actually quite nicely, too. Remember how the now Biden-Fuhrer blasted President Trump's southern border wall, and then, when the opportunity arose, canceled all further funding for it? But the same team just approved $40 billion to Ukraine to ensure that its border isn't porous against Russia, and their aggression. And that $40 billion would have completed the entire southern border wall several times over. Furthermore, he doesn't say this, but I will, other analysts have noted that the weaponry that's being sent to Ukraine will, in fact, diminish what the United States has for its own defense. And maybe that's a big part of the equation anyway. I guess, after all, if you're going to kill off a bunch of soldiers, sailors, and Marines, you really don't need weapons for them to use to defend a country you intend to destroy from within, right? So, he says, any rational observer might conclude that the U.S. government intends to uphold the universal idea of natural sovereignty, internationally recognized borders, and the security of citizens inside its own country, well, at least as long as they're not natural-born American citizens. There are currently, he has, over 550 sanctuary jurisdictions established by state and local governments, or at least those now masquerading as them. And they aim, or so they say, to prevent federal immigration authorities from deporting illegal alien invaders, including tens of thousands detained by law enforcement for committing any number of heinous additional crimes, from rape to murder. The United States hasn't experienced such blatant nullification of federal law, arguably since the pre-Civil War era, or maybe the 1960s when Southern governors defied federal efforts to enforce civil rights legislation. But he asks another important question. Can any citizen now simply vote to declare their hometown or their local county immune from federal legislation? Now, full stop here just for a second. And ironically, I have to note, back when we had a rule of law, there was something called 16 Amsure Section 177, which told us that an unconstitutional statute is, although having the form and name of law, in reality, no law at all. It's wholly void, ineffective for any purpose whatsoever, and is thus inoperative. Void, not real law. No one's bound to obey an unconstitutional law. No courts are bound to enforce it. Well, suffice it to say, although we'll come back to this if time permits, that is not what these states are doing. What they're doing is saying, we want the United States to be invaded and destroyed, and we're going to do anything we can to rip down the Constitution and any actual law that's consistent with it. But still, though, Victor Davis Hanson is making a great point. Can any citizen simply now vote to declare their hometown or local county immune from, let's even put it this way, unconstitutional, anti-law, so-called legislation? Can a city or county nullify as it pleases? Well, things like the U.S. or IRS tax code, various unconstitutional endangered species laws, or, of course, the total travesty of federal gun registration, red flag laws, and anything else that infringes the once constitutionally protected Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. Or is nullification only permissible if it's in the interest of non-citizens, invaders, lawbreakers, you know, those who want this country destroyed? These asymmetries, and that's an interesting term he picks there, also transcend non-citizens. We've developed, it seems, an entire class of American elite citizens, think Hitlery, Obama, and of course the Biden-Fuhrer, who are not subject to enforcement of the law, certainly not the way that it's applied to lesser peons, who are either less influential or not as politically correct. Federal prosecutors, for example, sought to jail retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn for 6 months for lying to federal agents. But wait, when it comes to Michael Sussman, lawyer for Hitlery? Hardly. What's good for the goose is not good for the gander. And yeah, Orwell was right. Some animals really are a lot more equal than others. They also put Trump subordinate George Papadopoulos in jail for lying to federal prosecutors. Recently, though, in contrast, the FBI stormed onto an airport to arrest a former Trump advisor, Dr. Peter Navarro, for contempt of a mere congressional subpoena. But wait a minute. What about Eric Holder? He brazenly defied congressional subpoenas, plural, and was found in contempt of Congress, an historic first. And you remember what happened to him, or maybe you don't, because he simply went on to, basically, let's call them what they were, greater and greater bribes. So, defying federal law has consequences, well, unless you're allowed to do it. James Clapper, former director of national intelligence, how's that for a whopper, confessed that he flat-out lied under oath to a congressional committee. And you know what happened to him? Or, again, maybe you don't. Answer, nothing. How about former CIA chief John Brennan, who lied under oath twice, and nothing happened to him? He did, though, still get to participate in the insurrection against Trump. Deputy FBI Director, the evil Andrew McCabe, repeatedly lied to federal investigators as acting director of the FBI, and not one of these people were arrested or tried in the manner of any number of Trump associates and constitutionalists and conservatives and even libertarians, people like Flynn, Papadopoulos, Navarro, and the list goes on, especially a whole bunch of people held in the federal gulag since January the 6th. There are lots and lots of reasons, says Victor Davis Hanson, why the looming November midterms will probably see historic levels, and they should, of pushback against the tyrannical Biden regime, along with other Democrat, Socialist, Bolshevik candidates, and the entire so-called progressive agenda. Now here, folks, again, I have to note, we'll see, even if it's not reported, how many of those votes end up getting counted. More importantly, whether it's enough to matter, and of course, those who once again will no doubt try to pull the wool over Americans' eyes, probably still think that even if they get caught, they own the just us system, and nothing of consequence, this time too, would dare happen to them. Take your pick among the many self-induced Biden disasters. Arguably, most of them planned. Things like hyperinflation, gasoline and diesel completely unaffordable, out-of-control crime rates, foreign policy humiliations, like Afghanistan, which coincidentally armed terrorists even while honest Americans are being disarmed by that same regime. But one reason, suggests Victor Davis Hanson in conclusion, that voters are furious is rarely expressed. Americans feel that ordinary citizens like them, who follow the rules, obey what, even if they're wrong about it, they think amounts to law, are treated a lot more harshly by what they thought was their own government than are both non-citizens and illegal invaders, and the so-called progressive elites that want them not only ruled over with an iron fist, but in most cases, dead. They're right, he says, they're angry, and hopefully we'll feel the heat from them very soon. Since I alluded to it earlier, and have talked about it frequently on this network, but I realize it's been a while, and certainly we have new listeners since then, and regardless, all of us, every single one of us, ought to be familiar with the concept here, and it's getting increasingly important that we not only understand it, that we walk in accordance with it, especially if we understand that we have a choice of law from our Creator, so we'd better choose correctly. Here's the quote from 16th American Jurisprudence, 2nd edition, section 177, also called Amjur, section 177. The general misconception, says this bastion of American law, is that any statute passed by legislators bearing the appearance of law constitutes the law of the land. Well, they say the U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and any statute to be valid must be in agreement. It is impossible for both the Constitution and a law violating it to be valid. One or the other must prevail, and this is succinctly stated as follows. The general rule is that an unconstitutional statute, though it has the form and name of law, is in reality no law, but is wholly void, ineffective for any purpose, and its unconstitutionality dates from the time of its enactment, not merely from the date of a decision so branding it. As unconstitutional law, and that needs to be in quotes, in legal contemplation, it is as inoperative as if it had never been passed. Such a statute leaves the question that it purports to settle just as it would be had the statute not been enacted. And by the way, folks, this goes especially for abominations, infringements, like so-called red flag gun laws, which trash even the concept of due process to boot, and registration, and basically all of those things, again being pushed by tyrants to disarm their intended victims before the inevitable historic final solution. Since an unconstitutional law, it continues, is void, the general principles follow. That it imposes no duties, confers no right, creates no office, bestows no power or authority on anyone, affords no protection, and justifies no acts performed under it. It goes on to note, obviously, that an unconstitutional law cannot operate to supersede any existing valid law. And no one is therefore bound to obey an unconstitutional law, and no courts are bound to enforce it. And furthermore, folks, all of us need to understand what real law is, and increasingly, what it is not. Choose this day whom you will serve. Thanks for joining us, and may Yahuwah bless you and yours.